Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. The podcast explores how Delawareans connect to the environment and cultures around them, and the cultural practices and creative works that bring us closer to the planet we call home. On this episode, we focus on Indigenous dance and its connections to the environment, as well as its role in connecting Delawareans to the land and history of Indigenous people in the First State. To help us make and understand these connections is Herman Jackson of the Nanticoke Tribe in Delaware, where he serves as spiritual advisor. Jackson has performed tribal dances throughout the state and around the country since 2012. So let's start with a little history lesson about Indigenous tribal dance. You know, what are its roots? What was the original purpose?
Now, from what I've learned, before contact, before the Europeans come over, everything was prayer dances. They always told a story back to the Creator to thank Him. So if they were on a hunt, some dances reflect being on a hunt and killing your game, or even if you chase away warriors that were encroaching upon you, you would give thanks. So it was always to give thanks back to the Creator for what He had given us.
And so that would be, you know, health, the well-being of the environment around you,
the
animals around you, crops.
Yeah.
So basically, it was a large way of like thanking the Creator for kind of the abundance around them. Or I guess if there was an abundance at the time, hoping for that.
Yeah, the so-called rain dance.
Mm-hmm.
There actually was a dance to ask for rain, from what I was told way back. But it was not rain specific, just
right. In
general. And our grass dance
mm-hmm.
goes back to where the Plains Indians, when they moved camp, them dancers would go out and step on the grass
mm-hmm.
to flatten it out so they have their encampment. And then when they move to the next one, the grass could spring back up and continue on living.
So in a lot of ways, it was a way to kind of connect not only with the Creator, but with the environment around
you. To the environment, yes.
It's fascinating. So tell me a little bit about how it developed over time. How did it go from what we've just talked about as kind of these prayers to more of what we see today? How do we get from point A to point B?
The best I'd come up with was back during the 1880s, 1890s, the Wild West shows
mm-hmm.
come into effect. Sitting Bull and all of them, they reenacted. And that's where they started performing more. And like it stated, if I say a prayer dance, nobody will come and see it. If I call it a war dance, they'll pay money to come and see it. And it's the same dance. So it tells the same story. They just changed the name to draw in people. They done it for revenue.
Yeah, so in a lot of ways it was about, as you mentioned, the revenue. It was also about kind of connecting with communities and trying to kind of get people to be involved with any given tribe.
Yes, and one thing about it, when back in the Wild West shows, the Native Americans went bare-chested. They didn't wear a lot of clothes and all. And they say the men and women, the Europeans, didn't like to see them out there, so they made them start wearing shirts. At one time, the one-piece long underwear
mm-hmm.
was part of regalia. They would have to wear that and aprons over it just so they were covered up.
So that was it did become more – that added to the performance, right? It gave people a reason to come in, not just to see the dance, but to see the regalia, the garb that they were wearing.
Because they got paid by the amount of people they drew in.
Mm-hmm.
So the flashier they dressed
mm-hmm.
and moved, the more money they made. So that's why a lot of dances went from contemporary – or traditional to more contemporary dance.
Did they when they started adding the garb in and adding the regalia in, was there an effort to connect that to the dance, to the message, use it as symbolism for anything? I guess was there a purpose behind the garb besides just saying, hey, we're going to dress things up a little bit?
Not back then per se, from what I understand, but you got to remember at one point about 1883, 1884, the ghost dance come out.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they thought they could bring the spirits back and the indigenous people could take back our land. Mm-hmm. But our government was scared of it. They didn't understand it. So they forbidden any gathering. We couldn't wear feathers, none of regalia. They stripped us of all of that. We could not have religious freedom. Mm-hmm. We couldn't go to a ceremony. We couldn't do ceremonies. They stripped that out, and that went clear up. And if you believe it or not, to 1978. Mm-hmm. Actually, Jimmy Carter just passed. He was the president that signed the Religious Freedom Act. Mm-hmm. So that part of history ain't that old, because we remember Jimmy Carter.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I was going to say, as we move into the present day, how much has it changed from that point in time until today, you know, in terms of purpose, the dances themselves, the regalia that goes with them? You know, what is like some of the meaning behind the things that are done today now?
Well, today, you got to remember, we got basically two different powwows.
Mm-hmm.
One is traditional,
yep,
and one is competition. Competition, you compete for payout, for money. And Midwest, all them big powwows, I mean, first place would be a couple thousand dollars. Mm. So that powwow kind of taken over, because you get more and better dancers, and more dancers, more drums, the more spectators you draw.
Mm-hmm.
Where ours, which is in Millsboro,
yep,
it is actually a traditional. All we do is offer them lunch. So they show up on their own pocket money, because it's expensive going to different powwows depending on where you live. So we all try to offer them a great lunch, but you talk to them and they enjoy it because it's not competition. They say they're right there. They can, like, reunite with Mother Nature, with our ancestors, because they're not competing or nothing. They're just out dancing and enjoy it.
So the tone is different.
Yeah, oh, completely. Okay. Competition powwows, they don't even want to talk to you. I mean, it's a lot of people don't even like going, because they don't socialize as much as a traditional powwow. Traditional powwow, you can sit down beside someone, they'll share their lunch with you or whatever and talk to you and give you tips of what you done wrong or right.
So is there a sense that the traditional powwow harkens back more to the original purpose and meaning of the dances and the connecting with the creator, connecting with the land, connecting with the environment?
Oh, completely. Because, like I say, you're there only, you want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you get out of it. It's the satisfaction of going in that sacred circle and dancing for the creator or your relatives around you.
Mm-hmm. So talk to me a little bit about when you perform, you know, examples of these dances and what the meaning you're trying to convey, the stories you're trying to convey. Can you give me an example of, okay, if you're going to perform somewhere, what is that dance like and what are you trying to do?
Well, my dance is traditional Southern straight dance.
Mm-hmm.
Each dance has its own style, its own regalia.
Mm-hmm.
I wear a trailer. We all wear ribbon shirts, leggings, aprons, but then we change up. Traditional Northern wears a feather bustle, a big round circle of feathers on their back, and their dance is way different. The drum beat is different. When you go to a powwow, if you listen real close, you know there's a Southern drum and a Northern drum. Two completely different drums singing everything. But like I say, a Southern style dance is you're going out and you're telling the story of a hunt or a fight, a battle you were in, and you're showing the creator what you've done and thanking him. That part has not changed. Mm. The story's still there. Northern, it still tells a story. The story's still there. Then you get into other dances like fancy dance. Some of them ain't been around for, 50 years or so, not old at all.
Relatively new.
Yeah. The contemporary dance style, and in their own right, they're just as pretty. The spectators loved the fancy dance with all the feathers and movement and everything.
When you're outperforming, how much of it is about yourself and those who you're dancing with, and how much is it about making sure you're engaging with the spectators that are on hand?
It all depends what powwow I'm at.
Okay.
If I'm at my powwow at ours, they are my guest. So I think it's my job to go out and talk to them to make them feel comfortable. And I will cross over the rope and just go out and talk to the public, whoever's standing around, little kids, grown-ups, take pictures and all. And I think that is part of my job because they are my guests.
Mm-hmm.
When I go to other powwows, then I'm a guest there. So I get to go out and dance. And even there, I will leave the circle and go talk to the spectators to see how they're doing, if they're enjoying it, if they want to know something about a dance at all.
Mm-hmm.
If I can tell them, I'm more than happy to explain things to them. And I have more fun doing that than dancing because I'm old. My bones don't take it as much.
Well, what kind of reactions do you get? What kind of questions do you get when you're out engaging people at a powwow?
Oh, back to regalia. A lot of them say, are you real Indian?
Mm-hmm.
That's a big question.
But that's an interesting question, right? Because that kind of gets to the heart of trying to make people aware of indigenous communities around them. Because it seems odd that someone would not know if you're a real Indian or not, right? I mean, that's kind of like an odd question if you take a step back and think about it.
Well, you look at TV. That's what killed us.
Mm-hmm.
They always got the long braids and all Indians did not wear long braids. All Indians did not live in teepees.
Mm-hmm.
All Indians did not ride horses. So the stereotype that TV showed, and by the way, the earlier black and white TV shows, most of them Indians were Italian actors. They wouldn't even use Native Americans to play Native Americans. But then you get to real life. I got a brother. He got blue eyes. I got green eyes. So we're all over the rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
That's just in a family.
Mm-hmm.
So people, it's hard to tell if you're real Indian because their concept of a real Indian come from TV.
And I was going to say, I guess that's part of what your hope is with these type of events and going beyond the powwows to other events and things like that is to let people know that this community still exists and kind of let them know the history of why perhaps they don't know about the Nanticoke here in Delaware or the Lenape, because they, in some ways they were kind of pushed away and pushed aside and hidden.
Yeah. Well, like I said, way back it was assimilate or eradicate.
Mm-hmm.
Two choices. Which one would you choose?
Right.
So they hid. They became what people saw them as. So if they could pass for white, they were white. If they passed for black, they were black. If they, that word mulatto is a made-up word, and I don't like using it.
Mm-hmm.
The same as saying Moor up here. Because the Lenape, from what I understand, Moor was actually a Spanish group of people way back.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a farm up here, and the owners were Moor.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them worked on there like a plantation.
Sure.
And that's where the term come from what I understand. And I never did like it. But that's a cross they have to bear.
Right.
And explain to people that, you know, mulatto, Moor are just made up names.
Right.
And they really have no significance to us.
So, you know, you talked about some of the other places that you perform outside of the powwows. Talk a little bit about that and what you hope to do at those performances, whether let's start with maybe like younger kids, schools and things like that. What is your goal when you go to perform there and kind of what kind of reaction do you get from younger folk?
Well, I take a lot of artifacts, per se, furs and all, and I lay them out and pass them out, let them touch it, so they get to feel what a coyote would feel like.
Mm-hmm.
Our skunk, we always have a lot of fun with the skunk. Then there's beaver, muskrat, possum, all of these furs and different things that we let them touch and explained to them how they were used back in the day, that they were made for clothes, blankets. We got gourds that we grew for make bowls with, utensils, how we use bone for tools. Man, you name it, all of it. So bark basket.
Yeah, I was going to say, a real chance for them to understand how indigenous communities really lived off the land. And so all these things that you see around you, that was part of their tools, their clothing, and all those type of things that I'm sure, like, for students, for younger children, in our world, say, you don't see, like, you see computers and you see, you know, utensils and stuff. They're made out of metals. And this is like a whole different thing that for them.
Yeah, and like third, fourth, fifth graders, you talk about the leather, wearing it and all, how it's skin, and they think it's really bad, you know, say, ooh. And then you ask them if they own a leather coat. And they say, yeah, leather sneakers.
Same thing.
What do you think that is? I said, it's even worse because it's probably pig or cow.
Right.
Or horse.
Not as high quality.
Yeah. So they can put it together, but they still learn that we were here. This year, the different schools we go to, third grade, they had a just recent studied Native American. And some schools, I was surprised how much they did know. You know, they knew what a wigwam or wikiup was. They knew that the East Coast didn't live in teepees. And I give credit to the teachers and all
that. Is that encouraging that younger folk really have a better understanding than maybe people our age even have?
Yeah. But then you talk to the teachers and they say they're limited to what they can teach.
Right.
Who teaches it and all, which is, you know, we always think without Native American history, there is no United States history.
Right.
But they kind of forget the one and teach the other.
Right.
But, yeah, I always feel good when they ask good questions and I know they'd learned something. And I always try to thank the teachers for that.
I want to go back to talking about the annual powwow and just ask you how important that event is to the Nanticoke in terms of connecting to its own history and its own community, as well as connecting and bringing other people in to learn about the Nanticoke.
Well, number one is our annual powwow is we do that to have an income because we support a center and a museum. We got the only true Native American museum in the state. So we need the revenue to keep all of that going. So our powwow is our fundraiser for those two items. Plus we get grants and all.
Right,
I got to put that out there too. The state does kick in a little teeny bit.
Right.
But they do something. But it does give us a chance to reach out to the community to let them know we are still here. You know, even though I talked to several people who say they ride by the museum every day, never stop in. And you say, why?
I was going to say, having the center and the museum certainly is an important piece of the puzzle. How important is that? And how much more are you hopeful you can do with that to, again, extend your reach and connect with more people, engage more people?
Oh, we try. We have Native American Day and Heritage Day at the museum. That's one at the beginning of the year, May, I think, and then another one in November. And there are two we put on right there at the museum, and we sell food and all, and it's open to, we invite the public. We want the public to come in, and they get a chance to go to the museum and everything.
Tell us about what's in the museum.
Oh, we got artifacts. A lot of arrowheads, all different things that the community, there's a section where the Nanticoke had made eel pots, fishing nets, all different beadwork they've done, pine needle baskets, all a little bit of everything. And it's all just for Nanticoke, which would be local.
Right.
And then we got a lot of other stuff from different tribes that were donated. It's hard to say.
But it's a good. It sounds like it's a good snapshot of what the Nanticoke was about, is about, and its connections to kind of the world around it, the environment around it.
Well, you take an arrowhead. People think it's just a piece of stone. But in the beginning, that stone probably come out of Pennsylvania because they have the flint.
Right.
Down on the beach, we don't have flint. We have very little you can make arrowheads with. So that stone made its way from Pennsylvania all the way down to, say, Laurel, Vienna, and was traded for clams, shell food,
right?
You know, or something.
Right.
And then they take that stone and then they nap it, shape it, and make that arrowhead. And then that arrowhead might travel old down Pocomoke or over Assateague Island or so, where he has to travel to hunt and shoot his game. And usually you try to get your arrowhead back, but not always.
Right.
So you think of the distance that one piece of stone traveled and what it went through.
And I said, and all the things that are involved in it, because you talk about, you know, the hunting the game, but also like the trading of the clams and the other. So it's, you know, so the Nanticoke had that resource by the bay and the sea.
Yeah.
And they were able to use that to connect with the stone and the flint they needed for the arrowhead, which then led for them to be able to get the game that they needed. So it's interesting how it's also interconnected.
Yeah, it ain't just an arrowhead.
Right.
It's a story with every little stone in there, if you think about it.
It is incredibly fascinating. You know, as we start to wind down a little bit, how effective do you feel dance, other parts of tribal tradition, like the museum, the artifacts, are in educating and giving people a better understanding and engaging them and helping them really learn about, as you said, this community that's always kind of been there in their backyard?
Well, we know we can't depend on schools to teach about us. So it is, if we want to be recognized and all, we have to go out and present ourselves. And like I say, we go to schools from one end of the state clear to the other. We've been in New Jersey to a school. We were invited over there. Me and my partner, Officer Mike Harmon, we go, you know, and do these performances, and we might pick up somebody to help us out, but usually it's us two. And we made trips out to Lebanon, Missouri. We took dancers out to Lebanon, Missouri, because he knew, actually, Chief of Police of Dover, moved down to Texas, became a Texas Ranger. But anyway, they do chuck wagon cooking for wagons for warriors, for wounded vets and all. They raise money. And they said they didn't have no Indians. It was always cowboys. So Mike got the big idea that we're going to go out there and represent. And we done made six trips out there.
And provide that part of the story.
Yeah, for way out there. And they have their own, because they ain't but 2 hours from Oklahoma.
Right, right.
And we all know Oklahoma is where all the majority of the indigenous people ended up. But we could do that. Old schools in Wilmington and just all over. And you watch them when they go out, and this little girl might come up and give you a hug, or this little boy come up and give you a hug on the way out. And you know you've done something then.
As you look ahead, are you hopeful that the identities of tribes like the Nanticoke are kind of being better remembered and better understood and are being part of, as you mentioned, the tapestry of the history where maybe they hadn't been for many, many years?
Yeah, because nowadays I know the Pocomoke, they do similar to same things. They don't have dancers, but they demonstrate a lot. And I go to them and I learn a lot just from them. We were at Mattapani in down Maryland, and they have people that do show artifacts and like an outreach to the way they live, not just the dancing,
right?
Not just the power, but the way they lived and all. And to me, that's more important. The dancing gets them there, but then we teach them about our tribal history and all.
I was going to say, as you look ahead, is there anything you'd like to see more of, or you would like in a perfect world to help people connect better and know more of the history better?
Yeah, I would like to see more of our tribal people step up and start doing more, because, like I say, it ain't but two of us. And I got to admit, we waited till after retirement.
Right.
Because we go all middle of the day. Sometimes we do two schools in one day. And it's time consuming.
Absolutely.
Because you got to factor in the ride to get there and the only a 20-minute performance. But you got 4 hours tied up in that 20 minutes. Mm. So to have more people helping out would be great.
Extend your reach.
Yeah. And even I know Nanticoke Lenny LaLape out of Bridgeton, New Jersey. They do some of the same things because they're like sister tribes.
Sure.
And Dover, we get help from them. We come up Dover. We've even done Dell Tech early learning.
Sure, yeah.
It's somewhere up here.
Yep.
We were up here this year, done a program there for little kids
yeah.
and the bigger kids and the adults. So, yeah, if we can just keep on doing it, let me say, you might, if you anybody in Dover area knows Bruce Morris, Bruce Little Drum Morris. He started doing this, like 40 years ago. He would go out to schools, Boy Scouts, but he started it way back before anybody else even thought about it. Unfortunately, he passed this year, but just to mention him for what he had started, because I do it, because he did it, and I helped him for a while, then, you know, I figure I owe it to him to continue.
And the hope is the tradition will continue
beyond. That somebody behind me is coming up.
You've been listening to a portion of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet, with Herman Jackson of the Nanticoke Tribe in Delaware. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. People and Planet is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities.